I ran a kosher deli down old Virginia way, not far from the Pentagon and the CIA. An admiral got heartburn, two generals passed away. That's when my country called on me to trick for the USA. Oh, I was whisked to Langley in a foreign service car. Asked to go to Cuba, set up my deli bar. Irving sliced the same pastrami you fix here every day. Let's hope big enchilada one day will come your way. Oh, I sliced pastrami for the CIA. Armed with just a butcher knife and a roll of Cuban bills, they flew me in a southeast line, they dropped me in some hills. I floated to Havana, and I am proud to say, I set up a little deli, hoping he'd come in one day. Well, one day soon it happened in the afternoon lunch crowd. The spirited man he entered, so arrogant and proud. I hear you got pastrami that could give the devil fright. Don't be chintzy with the mustard, let's see if they are right. Now I knew he was a tough guy, the mafia missed its turn. But where they failed with poison, I'd nail him with heartburn. They could not make his beard fall out so that he'd look less viral. Boldly I sliced a double one, I'd freeze his Cuban smile. Oh, I sliced
the
Well, Fidel took one bite from it, his sun-brown face turned white. He began to choke and gasp, but he asked for another bite. Just then the sky split open, a voice cried loud and shrill, Irving, take back that pastrami, I said thou shalt not kill. Well, Fidel, he got angry, but I was out of reach. Miraculous, this hand comes down, I'm flown half price to Miami Beach. I'm back at my old deli and somehow very proud. I sliced pastrami for the CIA, and that's how I found God. I sliced pastrami,
Well, that fun song was by Sherwood Ross. Sherwood was a regular guest on the New American Dream for many years. Unfortunately, he died a few years ago, but I miss him so much, and it was great to hear his voice again. Tonight, I have a treat. We have Sheena Powell Zuri, who is a poet, an activist, a yoga teacher, and a scientist. As part of a thriving South Florida poetry community, Sheena is proudly affiliated with the Miami Poets, the Florida State Poets Association, and Famous Last Friday's poetry group at Books and Books. She serves on the board of directors with the South Florida Writers Association. She's presented original works of poetry and live reads at the O Miami Poetry Festival, the U.S. Speak Open Verse and Story Performance Series, and Odd Blue Roses. She served as poetry and prose judge for the Junior Orange Bowl Creative Writing Contest and the Miami VA Creative Arts Festival. She has produced several successful community poetry events, notably Beat Poetry at Le Chat Noir and a tribute to Sherwood Ross. She was a 2016 recipient of a grant with the Writers' Room at the Betsy Hotel in South Beach to support the completion of her upcoming first collection of poems. polyhymnia, a passion of truth, beauty, and love drawn from nature, personal relationships, and art, with music as muse. She is also a political activist, a yoga teacher, and holds a day job as a scientist. She's an amateur poet. She's still looking for the answers and still dreaming. Sheena, welcome to the show. And thank you so much for agreeing to be on. And why don't you take it from here?
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you so much for having me. I have a smile from ear to ear, and it was so great to, you know, thank you for that introduction, but it was so great to open the show today with Sherwood Ross's I Slice Pastrami for the CIA. That the pastrami song is a great song, Chuck. It's a bona fide classic. there were as I understand it, there were many ideas for possible assassination modes for Fidel Castro, and this song brings a little humor to an impossibly true story. I do know that during the 80s, Sherwood was also a regular at the Greenwich Village folk music scene, and he made quite the name for himself performing offbeat material such as the pastrami song, and there were crowd favorites such as the Nightmare Room about being in a mental institution, and also Don't Go to No Sperm Bank about a couple who wants to return their not so great child from artificial insemination. But funny, Sherwood had 5 original songs actually recorded on the Fast Folk label. The pastrami song was the most popular, the most well-renowned, and it was later published. The Fast Folk label, it was later published by the Smithsonian in the Folkways Records. So it's nice that humor, that satire, that artistic expression, it's memorialized forever with the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, shall we go ahead and play? I have an excerpt from one of the shows that Sherwood did on our radio show, and I think this is a good time to jump into that.
Perfect.
Yes. Okay.
Love to hear it.
Well, it was a sunny day in June in 1966. In fact, it was blazing hot when James Meredith and a few others, myself included, started out from Memphis, Tennessee, headed for Mississippi on a march against fear and to demand that black people get the right to vote. Howling mobs lined both sides of Highway 51 leading south out of Memphis and into Mississippi. The mobs were screaming at us. Some of the bigots dressed up in Confederate uniforms rode along the highway beside us, waving the Confederate flag from horseback. Some of the riders carried sabers, so we might have been cut down like knights of old on some European battlefield. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen because the Tennessee State Police came between us and the demonstrators. They drove their police cars between Meredith and our group and the howling mob. If demonstrators got too close and tried to spit on us, the Tennessee State Police pushed them away. The Tennessee State Police were polite. The Tennessee State Police were firm. And the result was that when we reached the Mississippi line, the members of our little band were alive and well because the Tennessee State Police did their job. And there's a lesson for us in that today. That night we went back to Memphis to get a good night's sleep. That is, all the others went back to Memphis, And I caught a cab and taxied out to the Mississippi state line to have a look-see around. The place was eerily quiet. I decided to call the Mississippi governor's office, but he wouldn't come to the phone. I wanted to ask him, are you going to have the Mississippi State Police protect us the way the police did in Tennessee? I never got an answer. So I called the local sheriff in Hernando County, Mississippi, and told him I was the press coordinator for Meredith, and I said, are your county police going to protect us tomorrow? And the sheriff replied, we're going to treat James Meredith the way we treat any other nigger in the field chopping cotton. Well, you didn't have to come from Mississippi to know what he meant by that. That attitude explained 200 years of lynchings, torture, murder, and a million Bibles gathering dust because nobody in Mississippi was reading the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount for Love Your Neighbor. After hearing the sheriff's reply, I called my former employer, Whitney Young, of the National Urban League in New York, and I said, Whitney, looks like we're going to get shot tomorrow. Can you call over to the Justice Department and get us some protection? I was hoping for an FBI wagon with some agents who might make some arrests. Well, the next morning came, June 6, 1968, and the sun rose hot and fiery, and I met my friends at the state line, and we started to march into Mississippi. Meredith, cool and calm as ever, myself, scared stiff. Around 1:30 in the afternoon, we heard a rumor that a white man was waiting with a gun for us up the road. Meredith said, we'll walk for another half hour, then we'll knock off for the day. A few minutes later, the white man came out of hiding from a gully on the far side of the road. He had a rifle, and he walked calmly toward us, repeating, I only want James Meredith. When Meredith saw this armed man on the road with the rifle, he started to run, tripped, and fell face down on the highway. The man fired one shot and missed, then walked up to Meredith and fired at him point blank, hitting him in the back with countless buckshot pellets. Meredith screamed in agony, and the man walked off across cotton field. Calm as you please. I bent over Meredith, whose blood was on my shirt, and I said, Jim, the wounds are not that bad. You haven't lost a lot of blood. And the network camera crews that have been following us have called for an ambulance. This was in the days before cell phones, of course. And that time I saw the Hernando County police arrived, and they were putting the shooter in their police car. At that moment, the FBI also arrived, and two G-men came running up to me and said, who did it? I then realized I had seen the FBI car cruising up and down the highway every 10 minutes or so that morning. What a shock. If they'd only trailed Meredith by a few feet, if they had stuck close to him, they might have prevented the shooter from hitting him. It was a fact, of course, that J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI chief, was a notorious racist. Could it be he didn't want to prevent the tragedy?
Wow. That's just an amazing story.
That's so powerful.
It is.
It really is, Chuck. Chuck, there were so many facets of Sherwood. We started off with this very humorous song. But Sherwood had many, many, many angles, and he had a great sense of humor, but he had an even more sense of justice.
And oh, yes.
In today, in our current day, our living history, in our current day, with the racial tensions that are rising with new fervor led, unfortunately, by our own commander-in-chief, who is supposed to be a model of dignity and inclusiveness and a role model on the world stage, to keep Sherwood's works alive, through these discussions and recordings and through his songs and his poetry, whether they're very humorous or whether they're very, very serious, like the story that he shared with his own voice. It's so powerful to hear his own voice recount a very true story. To keep those works alive, it's very critical. And even the excerpt of the beautiful poem, the New Colossus by Emma Lazarus, which is inscribed to the Statue of Liberty, is so important. And it's you know, the home page of your website shows the people coming to Ellis Island, right, overlooking the Statue of Liberty. This is such a powerful expression of humanity and what's right and what we strive for in our life. And Sherwood, you know, Sherwood dedicated that especially moving tribute poem, a tribute to James Meredith, titled Jesus in Mississippi, against that 1996 March Against Fear. I don't know, did you want, do we have time to read this poem? I know, well, Sherwood...
There's certainly time to start it, and we'll see if we get done. But please do. It's a very powerful poem. I'd love to hear you read it.
Yeah, it's a really powerful poem. So I think I'll read an excerpt so we can, you know, get through it. I know we have a lot of things that we want to cover on the show today, but I'll start with the point where Meredith is shot. So this is an excerpt from Jesus in Mississippi about the 1966 March Against Fear. Then the shooter rose up like a fat sea serpent, terrifying, crying, "I only want James Meredith." And then he fired and missed. Running for cover, our Jesus stumbled and fell to the pavement, and the shooter came upon us and shot him directly in the back, and then turned, calmly walked away, as if it were some play act. And I thought of going after him and knocking him down, of taking away his rifle and subduing him. But I thought of my children and told myself, don't be no hero, stay nonviolent, leave it for the police. And one of our band, the priest, yelled at the TV cameraman, stop taking pictures. Call an ambulance. And I bent over our Jesus, writhing in agony on the gravel with a back filled with buckshot, a shirt soaked with blood, and tried to reassure him, saying in his ear, your wounds are not that bad. You're going to be okay. For the blood was oozing, not spurting. And some of it was on my hands, and some of it was on my shirt, and some of it dribbled onto the Mississippi dirt. And when the ambulance came, we helped our Jesus in. I got up front with the driver, who refused to press down hard on the gas pedal or turn on the siren, because our Jesus was a man of brown skin. Outraged, I threatened, you will lose your job if you don't. And the driver became afraid, as did I demanded. Minutes later, when we got to the hospital in Memphis, the news of the shooting had flashed around the world. And in the lobby of the nearby Peabody Hotel, one white Southern belle gave the rebel yell. Segregation forever, someone else cried, hoping that our wounded Jesus might have died. The local sheriff arrested the shooter, who was tried and sentenced to 3 years, and from the knowledge of men, he disappeared. But our Jesus recovered and finished his march, which turned into a victory parade joined by all the heroes of the movement, with Reverend King and Stokely Carmichael, with Ralph Abernathy, Whitney Young. And where we started out just a handful, now hundreds walked on Highway 51, and the federal registrars descended on Mississippi and registered black and brown voters by the thousands, and their votes began to count. Their fate changed from subjects of benign neglect to valued citizens treated with dignity and respect. And our Jesus went on to write many learned books on the history of Mississippi, where the good people erected a statue in his honor. Hallelujah! Well, you may not believe our man was Jesus, but would you know Jesus if you met him? What would he have to do to convince you of his divinity? Jesus the Christ was not believed by many in his lifetime either. Today, Mississippi is very different than 1966. Its people are changed. Many among them have opened their hearts to people of other races, for our Jesus changed lives in Mississippi, just as the Jesus was the same man, just as the Jesus, the Christ, changed lives in Galilee. You may doubt our Jesus was the same man, but I tell you, I walked with Jesus in Mississippi, and we dined together in paradise under some shade trees on June 6, 1966. And that's the end of Jesus in Mississippi.
Well, that was wonderful. Thank you so much, Gina.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure.
It's time for our station break now. So I'd like to remind everyone, this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so be sure to head over to freedomslips.com and show them your support. Talk to you after the station break.
Find some comfort at Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne, and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the evening is Philip Perugio. Philip acts as my co-host for the second segment of the show. And we're going to kick off this segment with Philip's column that we recorded earlier in the week. So here that is right now.
All right. Good evening, Working Stiffs. Follow the leader. You know, as children, we all probably played the game, follow the leader. It was lots of fun and a purely safe game. Well, not so in this current low-based political and social culture here in America. Oh, boy. This writer has ranted and raged since August 2017 about what transpired in Charlottesville, Virginia, in regard to the white supremacist neo-Nazi marchers carrying Nazi-era torches and repeating the mantras of Jews will not replace us and blood and soil. Then, the president of our nation, when asked about his feelings on these events, failed to mention the aforementioned scene of blatant anti-Semitism as being horrific and utterly outrageous. No, he actually said that members of that group, along with members of what has been called Antifa, anti-fascist, both had some fine people in them. This opened the door to the skeleton closet that allowed all the neo-fascist ghouls out. Now, if you don't believe me, check out this. Louisville, Kentucky, recently, a white man, 51-year-old Gregory Bush, no relation, walked into a grocery store and shot dead 69-year-old Maurice Stallard and 67-year-old Vicki Lee Jones, both Afro-American and previously unknown to him. Bush had a criminal record that includes assault in the third degree, domestic violence, and making terrorist threats in 2009. How about this one? An Indiana woman, 63-year-old Deborah Cantwell, white, was accused of writing a racist note to a new family that was moving into her neighborhood in Greentown, Indiana. Indiana, by the way, is the home, original home of the KKK. She admitted to targeting a young black child that she saw moving into the home. Her note said, quote, "We moved here to a white town, all white neighborhood, for health reasons, among other things. This is our forever home. We cannot afford to move. Besides, this is my dream home, and we've been here for a very long time. You should have considered the neighbors. Just the sight of the child reminds me of all the things I live in this town to forget." Unquote. In her letter, Mrs. Cantwell said she has had negative experiences with black people, and seeing the child would cause her stress. When investigators questioned her, she admitted that she had written a letter because she was angry, suggesting that throughout the years, black people held her father at gunpoint, stabbed an uncle, and beat her sister. She admitted that she delivered the note and toilet papered the house out of rage, and that "I was trying to vent," she said. When asked if she now regretted her actions, she answered yes and no. How about this one? Two Afro-American women were waiting for AAA to come help them with their disabled car in a dark apartment complex parking lot in Charlotte, North Carolina. Susan Westwood, an apparently drunk white woman, approached them. She told them that she was a resident of the apartment complex, which, according to her, is one of the city's most exclusive neighborhoods, where they happened to be standing. She said she made $125,000 a year and pays a hefty rent. And then she said, quote, "This is Myers Park. What are you hanging out here on a Friday night? I am white and hot. So what are you doing here?" Westwood then got more outrageous. She said, and quote, "Is your boyfriend here? Is your baby daddy here?" Unquote. She then demanded to know where the two women lived and screamed, quote, "You're not going to sell drugs here. Do I need to bring out my concealed weapon too? This is North Carolina, by the way," unquote. The interesting thing is that one of the two black women, okay, Lesla Garris, did in fact live in the apartment complex. A 80-something friend of mine, Miss Mona, told of this account that she had going to vote back in November. Quote, "I went to early voting at a library in Daytona and was walking in to vote when a man approached me and asked me if I wanted some Republican flyers. When I said I didn't want them, he and his whole group started yelling, 'Baby killer,' at me. There were at least six of them, and my grandson came next to me, and then they backed off." To quote the old adage, an apple never falls far from the tree. Thank you. Well, that's pretty interesting.
Very powerful column there, Phil.
Pretty interesting, wouldn't you say?
I would say so.
You know, Chuck, here's the problem. You know, you have the Charlottesville March, August of 2 years ago. We know what the president said and what he should have said, but what he really alluded to was that there were people who were nice on both sides. And, you know, the white supremacist march, which was a neo-Nazi march, as we talked about in the past, you know, they were stating blood and soil, which comes out of 1930s Germany, and Jews will not replace us. And the president and his family, his son-in-law is Jewish, they didn't get enraged by this, you know? And so you set the tone. You set the tone when you don't do things that you should do, Chuck. And
yeah.
There's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of people out there. And, you know, we might not run into a lot of these people, but maybe we do. You know, they just have a low base mentality. And when they see that the president of the United States, well, it's like with the Iraq invasion. I mean, you know, you and I both knew back in 2003 that this whole thing was a bunch of baloney with these weapons of mass destruction and, you know, with the inspectors and everything. We really felt that there was something that the public just was not really knowledgeable of, but we were, as people that study news and look at behind the scenes. And so what happens, we go and we invade Iraq, we attack the country, probably the worst horrific act that we've ever done in the 21st century, at least. And what happens, people come out of the woodwork who are supporting this action, right? You know, I mean, I had so many arguments with people where I live, at the gym I go to. I mean, there was so much hostility towards anyone who didn't agree with what the United States had been doing, you know, in March 19th of 2003 with the invasion and, you know, the attack, the shock and awe. And so what happens when you have leaders who set the tone by either doing something or by not doing something, then you have a lot of people who might not be very knowledgeable of the facts come out of the woodwork and become very angry and very, very violent. And so I think that's what's happening now.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. But,
well, you know, I'm, go ahead.
In the first segment today, we played Sherwood Ross, who was one of our guests for the first several years of the show, talking about a march in the 1960s. He was marching with James Meredith, and they went from Mobile, Tennessee, or from Memphis, Tennessee, to Mobile. I don't know. They went into Mississippi.
Mobile, Alabama. Yeah,
right.
Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
With James Meredith. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. By the way, this is Sheena Powell Zuri that's on with us, Phil.
Okay.
Hello, Phil.
She did.
Hi.
Okay.
How you doing?
and in any case, in that march, James Meredith was shot. He survived, but it was a things seemed like they changed for a while, but now it's almost as though they're switching back to the hate and racism and divisiveness.
It's relevant. It's very eerie how something that happened in 1967, that March Against Fear, is so relevant today. That was just that you all were just talking about a few moments ago with what's happening now in our present day. It's all these years later, it's the same situation.
Exactly.
Well, you know, if you study history, which people should, but I'm a student of the whole, World War II era, and so some reason I'm fascinated by the whole Nazi era, because I just can't believe, every time I study that whole era, I can't believe how these people actually got into power. And they did it. They did it. They did it legally. I mean, they did it electorally.
Yeah.
The Nazis. Yeah. You know. So, of course, they used a lot of strong arm tactics. And but the point I'm making is that let's say prior to 1930, January 31st of 33, when he was actually appointed to be chancellor. So prior to that, there was a lot of violence, by the by his stormtrooper types, in the streets on people on people that were communists or were even social democrats or of course were Jews. But once he got into power, once Hitler took power, again it's very similar, folks, because once he became chancellor and the Nazis were in power in the Reichstag and everything else, then it just unleashed this acceptance of this horror, this violence, towards Jews, and of course towards people that were in unions, because the Nazis got rid of the unions in the enabling laws. So, but the leadership, the rot always, people always say the rot comes from the bottom. No, the rot comes down from the top, really what we have now in this country, and it's not my theory, because we're talking about facts. We're sitting here, the three of us, and we can see what's happening. And first you had the white police killing unarmed black men, right?
Yeah.
And nothing was really done that should have been done. I mean, even in New York, I mean, the mayor who's running for president, how many years did it take this guy to finally have that guy fired, have the cop fired that did the chokehold on Garner, which killed Garner?
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly.
So anyway, the point of the matter is that we have a president, and it's not only the president, it's the whole administration. And to a certain extent, even the Congress, because everybody talks the talk, but they don't walk the walk. I mean, you want to find reasons to impeach Trump. Don't look at the whole Russiagate thing. You know, forget about that. Look about what this guy is doing. You know, I mean, and the things he's done to circumvent the Constitution. So anyway, it's just a very sad time for us all. You know,
Philip, it's just that what is happening that you alluded to in the time of Hitler. It's very similar now in that things are happening very slowly and piecewise and little by little, that we don't feel these small changes. We don't feel these very minute shifts in the way that we're behaving or our global vernacular on how we deal with minorities and how we deal with the topics of race. And it creeps up on you. Little by little by little by little, as in Hitler's time, little by little by little, he came to power. And it's the same thing that's happening now. And going back to Sherwood's discussion at the top of the show about the March Against Fear, that at that time in the 60s, the event came to be known as the last great march of the civil rights era. And that's a very challenging notion, because truly our civil rights era does not end. It's now, and it's perpetual.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, yes.
And it's not only about black people. I mean, the thing that gets me. Let me give you an example. I'm on the phone a couple of days ago with one of my customers, and you know, I don't know the guy, but I do a lot of my sales, you know, over the phone all over the country, and I have you know, customers and clients. Anyway, this guy was 79 years old and a really nice guy. I mean, he was just he's a nice guy. I don't know him, but talking to him, having a long conversation, talking about other things other than, you know, other than business, other than the order he placed. And we started talking about things. And here's what I said to him. I said, well, I'm thinking about moving back up north, because I'm in Florida. You know, I'm thinking about moving back up north. And I mentioned a town, like a city in Pennsylvania that I was thinking about moving to. And he said, oh, no, you don't want to go there. He said, yeah, you know, it's that area is very diversified. That's the word he used. That's the code word for black people. Okay. And wait. And then we're talking some more. We're talking some more. And I mentioned about the hurricane that's coming, you know, the hurricane's coming. And it was a couple of days ago. I said, the hurricane's coming by next Sunday or Monday. And I said, you know, I think they said it's probably going to hit Puerto Rico first. And he goes to me, well, that wouldn't be so bad.
Huh.
That's what he said. Well, that wouldn't be so bad.
But yeah. But that's an American,
said, really?
An American territory.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but the point he was making was a racist. Yeah. Yeah, but the point he was making was a racist point. You know, there's all Puerto Ricans there. You know, it's when they come, when people come, especially when they're older. You know, when they're in their 70s, 80s. I mean, I speak to a lot of these guys down here where I live. And a lot of them are nice guys. They're not like mean-spirited, but they're racist. They are. I mean, they're racist, you know. And I had one friend of ours, very successful, you know, professional, white people, and they've lived down here all their lives in Central Florida, you know. And the woman was talking about the lady. His wife was talking to us about. And she goes, oh, yeah, well, that's Blacktown over there. Blacktown. I mean, my wife said, Blacktown. You know, we're from New York, but I never heard that expression. Yeah, that area is Blacktown, you know.
Uh-huh.
And this is real. And these people are not overtly racist. They're not. You know, they would probably say to you, you know, some of my friends are black, you know?
Yeah, right.
it's a mentality. And how many times, Chuck, I don't know, I socialize a lot. I go over to the simulcast. I used to own racehorses. I like to watch the horse racing. And I meet a lot of guys at the simulcast. And how many times guys want to tell me jokes? And, you know, a lot of these jokes, I mean, they're racist jokes, you know. about blacks. I mean, that's and they just tell the joke, and it's not funny to me, and you know, but it's funny to them because that's how they were brought up. It's really sad. I tell you the truth, it's really sad. It's getting worse. It's you're right. What you know, what she said and what you're saying, it's worse now. It really, it's worse now than I could ever remember. Really, you know.
Well, yeah.
But there's no, there's no era. It doesn't stop. We have to keep educating people, and we have to keep expressing. We have to keep sharing. It's the purpose of having this discussion on the show, you know, and sharing, sharing the commentary and also the expression of what we observe in our society. It's very important.
But can you, but can you two understand the fact that, because I've been writing about this since it happened, that in Charlottesville 2 years ago, August 12th, I mean, these are white, mostly men, there were some women, but mostly men, they're carrying torches, which are right out of 1930s Germany, purposely carrying those torches at night, and they're saying blood and soil, which is a Nazi you know, slogan that they used, and and they're saying Jews will not replace us over and over, and the media picked up on it, and then where was the outcry? I mean, the media, you know, obviously they showed it and they made some comments, but they didn't carry on with it. Do you understand what I'm saying? That was a focal point of the Trump administration. That was a moment. You know, you talk about the Democratic Party. If they had any balls or guts, they would have still been playing on that 2 years later, right? Mm. But they don't do that.
Phil,
sad. Very sad.
In the we have about 4 minutes left. What would you? How would you attack this problem? How would what would you do to change things?
Well, first of all, we have to have leadership in this country. I'm saying political leadership and you know, civic leadership too, to really talk about this. And I think what I would do if I had any sort of a power, I would have speakers go into all the junior high schools. You know, I mean you could say grade schools if you want, but I would say middle schools at least. And to go into the classes and to talk to these kids about racism and about anti-Semitism, you know, and explain to these kids what happened in Germany, what happened in the South with the Jim Crow era. You know, let these kids understand that this is starting to show its face again.
And share stories.
Yeah, and not only that, but I would play the video, the audio video footage of that Charlottesville march that night. I would play that to every single school kid in their class, in their civics or their political science class. That's what I would do. Let these kids see what other people in this country are saying and doing, you know, that is so horrific.
But
so horrific.
What about the march? Would you have somehow shut it down, or would you allow it to complete?
Well, there are two schools of thought on that. There are two schools of thought. There are those on the left. I consider myself to be on the left. There are those on the left who would say, no way should they, you know, no, you can let them march, but you got to show up in bigger numbers and you know, being in their face, like what happened over in Portland recently, about a week and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
where a group of anti-Fa types showed up and the people marching actually called the march off. You know, they got scared off. That's one way of doing it. I don't know. I mean, to me, I think if somebody has a permit and they want to march, we have freedom of speech. okay, not yelling fire in a movie theater.
Yeah,
you have freedom of speech. But I would do the footage. I would take footage of that march, and then I would use it again in the schools and in the public forum, you know, in churches and schools, to show the public what certain groups of people are doing right now and saying.
Well, I agree. We do have freedom of speech, and they need to be allowed to do their thing. But we've got to, show up and oppose it. And your idea with the footage is very good. Thanks very much.
Chuck, may I comment on that? Like, yes, we have freedom of speech, and this is the greatest thing here. But we have the leader of our country saying that there were good people, like Philip said, quoted.
Oh, I know.
That there were
good
people on both sides. That's not correct, you know. Yes, even the people that are not correct can have a voice. We cannot say, hey, that they're equal. No, we have to condemn acts. We have to condemn those acts, blatant acts of racism, and bring it to light. Really, really speak out against
right
that.
Okay.
And also, by the way, quickly, let me cut things loose.
I'm sorry, okay. There's
hey
no
everyone.
More time.
It's Barbara Jean Lindsay,
thank you both.
The Cosmic
this has been
Oracle.
A very interesting discussion. And
thank you. Need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career?
Talk to
you
after
your finger on the pulse of the planet.
Check
out my
thank
show.
You. Thank you, Phil.
The Cosmic Oracle here
thank
on
you.
Revolution
thank you.
Radio right. at freedomslips.com.
Bye-bye.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship. Or be quiet. Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship. You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth. You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Ohio Exo Politics will be on from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A. Mark Steyer will have guests on that will discuss many important topics, including the state of the world today. However, much of the show will be dedicated to the writings of Edward Albert Meyer. Let me read a short passage from one of his writings. Love is the highest principle of creation, and through it, everything exists in absolute logic. All of nature in its indescribable splendor is nothing but the love of creation, which is expressed visibly. The love of creation is everywhere, because without it, nothing at all would be able to exist. Please join Mark on Ohio Exopolitics from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back, everyone. We are now going to continue with Sheena Powell Zuri. And Sheena, take it away.
Hello. Hello. Yes. Hi. Hi, Chuck. It's been such a great evening. Thank you so much. And closing up the amazing discussions we had with Philip, and also the discussions about the March Against Fear and reading Sherwood's poem, there was documentation of that that incident or that occurrence by Jack R. Thurnell from the Associated Press, who won the 1967 Pulitzer Prize in Photography for his picture of the shooting of James Meredith in Mississippi. And Sherwood was in the thick of that. I only read an excerpt of his poem, but that was an award-winning poem. And he also wrote many other beautiful poems, such as Bon Voyage and The Astronomers, and also wrote anti-war poems, such as War No More, which is found on the U.S. Peace Memorial Registry. Sherwood's granddaughter, in fact, Melanie Ross Acuna, has gathered a lot of Sherwood's vast creative works, including his poems, and she presented them to the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation in honor of her grandfather's legacy. So I would encourage everyone that's listening to go to uspeacememorial.org, and Sherwood's the works of Sherwood Ross are memorialized in the U.S. Peace Registry, which is a publication of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, honoring Americans who stand for peace. So it's worth a look for sure.
Well, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Sherwood was really an amazing man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm adding Michael Annis, who is another of our monthly guests, into the discussion for this half hour. He's not on yet. He hasn't answered yet. But hello, Michael. You're on the air
Michael.
New American Dream Show with Chuck Gregory and Sheena Powell Zuri.
Hello, Michael.
I have come totally unprepared except for a discussion. And however, I have been listening to the entire show.
Oh, good.
And
good.
I found it fascinating and it's a beautiful tribute to Sherwood.
Mm.
Thank you.
well deserved, of course, for all of the
absolutely
work, everything he put in. So, yeah, and you know something, It's really interesting, the subject matter that you all have covered, you and Phil and Chuck, the three of you so far, that's how many I've heard, maybe there were more. But before your show came on, there's another show directly preceding your show with, amazingly, on Revolution Radio has a very interesting platform because this show was almost 180 degrees contrary to everything that you've been saying. Seriously,
really?
I am exaggerating. I'm not exaggerating. Yeah, they talked about Brexit. The person, and I didn't catch the names, and I don't think that even matters, and I don't know the name of the show, but it is, like I said, right before yours. And they were talking, it seemed like the focal point of the discussion was how wonderful it would be to live in a country of just white folks. This is no kidding.
Wow.
I thought, wow, this is Revolution Radio. What kind of a this is what is this?
What revolution is that?
Yeah.
How boring is that?
Wow.
And the brown shirts, are they getting ready to, you know, run through the streets? And so, yeah, but it is interesting because what that tells me is that people, and they were talking about this country being on the verge of civil war, not where people were going to be drawing guns and shooting cannons, but, you know, it was definitely going to be a civil war. And, you know, Donald Trump, even though he was elected for certain things and he hasn't really fulfilled those things, I don't want my segment here to be about Donald Trump. I'm just kind of loosely describing the character of their show and how divided it is. They, on the other side, I guess, have determined that indeed there shall be a civil war. And this is what everybody is talking about. This is the nature of this country from the very beginning, starting with the white possession of Indian lands, the possession of who was going to haul all the furs out of this St. Lawrence River, you know, the French and Indian Wars and all of that. It's just been century after century of us and them without a real cohesion, with always an enemy to try, and a nebulous enemy that takes on the names of disparagement. There's never any room for real discussion. So I'm continually hearing that. I have friends who now won't even talk to me, and I don't even have to say a word to them in response or rebuttal, that they won't even talk to me because they are so polluted by ideas for which there's very little foundation. So we're really living in times of propaganda.
Without foundation, right, Michael?
Without foundation. Propaganda without foundation.
Yeah.
And this, in quotes, historian, as he described himself, was completely, as far as I could see, in error of his perception of what was going on in the world and how to fix it. Because he's gathering his information from the internet, and the internet is full of ideas for which there is no foundation.
Certainly.
But you know what? There's something to be said with communication, Michael and Chuck. Like, Alan Alda wrote a great book or two about communication, and there was one passage, one statement that really resonates with me. It's like, good communication is coming to the table and being open to allow your mind to be changed.
Yes.
Well, yeah, that should go without saying.
Sure.
We should be able to go to people and allow our minds to be changed as long as there is a foundation which is presented in an articulate manner. Like, we can allow our minds to be changed by watching a group of people in in white hoods hanging a black man from a tree. We can allow our minds to be changed that way too. I'm talking about communication. All right. Okay. So I've made some other notes, and I don't want to bogart or because I really have come totally unprepared for this.
No, I love the discussion. That's what it's about.
There is no discussion. There is only me shooting off my mouth as usual. So anyway, I want to tell you, I loved the show prior to the point where I got on the show and found it extremely interesting. So.
Well, thank you.
I want to talk about poetry a little bit, since Sherwood was a fine poet. Mm-hmm. But I can't really talk about his poetry. I can talk about people who I knew and who I published and who I've read extensively. Mm-hmm. I want to remind everybody on this day of division in the United States that it is the anniversary of Charlie Parker's birth. His 99th birthday.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Born in Kansas City, Kansas. And they have, believe me, racist problems there. But he was born there, and I heard a beautiful thing on the radio, on public radio this morning. We have a great jazz station here, and several great DJs, but One of them played the Charlie Parker poem by Jack Kerouac, where Jack is accompanied by Steve Allen on the old Steve Allen show, piano. And
right, I know that
it's
poem.
Really, mm-hmm. an amazing piece. And this kind of segues into a point that I wanted to make, which is that. Okay, so years ago, I worked with a poet here who's now deceased, and he published a broadside after I commented on the poem. I said, wow, that's a great poem. You know, you really published a broadside, and he went ahead and, because of one line that stood out, and this really does come back. It comes back to what you've been saying. It comes back to what Phil was saying about how do you teach the children? You go into the schools and stuff. All right, and you get to them while they're young, and you point out that there are ways of living, higher living, than perceiving the world through racist eyes and through a racist mentality. So Larry Lake, a poet here, wrote a line, and that line in his poem was, "Oh, mighty Hague, when are the children to learn poetry?" And that kind of sums it all up. They learn all of this stuff, but they don't learn how to see through the eyes of a poet. Not really. You can, you have a world filled with political ideas and the tug of war and the war that results from intellectual tug of wars and economic mm-hmm. tug of wars and so on. But to teach the children poetry is to teach them a different way of perceiving the world. And there's no denying that some of our greatest poets have been people of color. And some of our greatest poets have been white too.
But there's a level playing field there.
It's like mm-hmm. music itself. You get a band together, and you get musicians, and nobody really cares who's what color. What they are interested in is the beauty that each one of them can contribute as individual to the group expression.
Right. And Michael, the beat poets were always all about that. You know, they were all about that expression. And they were actually making into art what was happening all around them in these tumultuous times. The beat poets started that movement. You know,
I used to drink Shivas Regal at Allen Ginsberg's apartment with Gregory Corso plotting our next move from his book. Now, I knew a lot of, I published a lot of the Beat Poets. I knew him personally. A lot of my work and a lot of my homages, like on The New American Dream, involved the Beat Poets. Yeah, I know. And that was one of my points that I was going to bring up, is that the perception of these poets. Charlie Parker looked like Buddha. Charlie Parker, who recently died laughing at a juggler on TV after weeks of strain and sickness, was called the perfect musician, and his expression on his face was as calm, beautiful, and profound as the image of the Buddha represented in the East, the lidded eyes, the expression that says, all is well. You know, it's from Jack Kerouac's Charlie Parker poem.
Yeah. And he continues with that with his San Francisco scene. I love that, you know, just like says, setting the tone and the scene for what's happening out there.
Right.
The heavenly drummer who looks up in the sky with blue eyes, with a beard, is wailing beer caps of bottles and jamming on the cash register, and everything's going to the beat. It's the beat generation. It's beat. It's the beat to keep. It's the beat of the heart. It's being beat and down in the world. And like old time lowdown, and like an ancient civilization, slave boatmen rowing galleys to a beat, and servants spinning pottery to a beat.
Yeah, so if we
gotta love that.
And if we could teach the children that there is a way of living on this earth, which is profoundly humane, and profoundly steeped in the unification of all colors and all nationalities. If we could just teach that. And I think that you can teach that through poetry. But you've got to read the poets, too. You don't just
write
it.
You got to read the poet. You got to share it, right? You have to share
I meet so many young people, and I ask them, well, who have you read? Well, I don't read. Well, how can you write poetry if you don't read? You know, there it's like, how can you play music if you've never heard music being played?
Yeah.
It's like the standards, right? The jazz has the standards, you know, the classics has the classics, you know, the Mozart and the Beethoven. And the poets have their, you know, their poets, their baseline, their beat line, you know.
Musically as important as Beethoven, yet not regarded as such at all.
Sure.
Genteel conductor of string orchestras in front of which he stood proud and calm, like a leader of music in the great history world night, and wailed his little saxophone, the alto, with piercing clear lament, in perfect tune and shining harmony. Toot.
I had a Chet Baker record on, and we hoofed at each other in the room. Tremendous, the perfect grace of his dancing, casual, like Joe Louis, casually hoofing. He now comes and dancing like that, glad. Everybody looks everywhere. It's jazz joint and beat generation, mad trick. You see someone, hi, and then you look away elsewhere for something, someone else. It's all insane. Then you look back, you look away, around. Everything is coming in from everywhere in the sound of jazz.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, Sherwood Ross was an amazing influence and inspiration to me. Just a stellar human being and truly the most incredible person I've ever known. And through his artistic expression, through poetry and through music, which you heard at the beginning of the show, and the excerpt that I read about Jesus in Mississippi, it's like you can reach people through that medium and make them think a little bit more about these racial issues and these challenges of our day. You know, we can, through poetry, through music, through expression, change people's minds, maybe give them a different outlook. That's what it's all about. And that's what the beat movement was all about too, right? Is to give a new look, a new eye, a new window to look through. There's something more profound out there, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, the beat, it was about living unlike other people had lived in the past, without that straitjacket of prejudices that are handed down from generation to generation, in which people born with no clothes on, the first thing they get is a lesson on how to buckle up their straitjacket and conform. And the beats were very much about how can we non-conform and make it a beautiful way to live.
I find it interesting how
you didn't have to march
Michael.
In the streets with you know, with a Nazi banner over them to say we're not conforming here. They wanted to do it in a way in which it was life-affirming and life-giving, in which they could find out what is it like. I mean, just on the road itself, just take the title. On the road itself, it's like
on
you get
road.
Out on the road and you blaze through this thing called life. And once again, to you do it in a way in which your mind is open and wants to absorb everything, wants to take it all in, and wants to try to cohere it to everything else.
I find it interesting that you allude to this straitjacket of prejudices. I love that line, because Ginsberg's mother and Naomi was institutionalized.
Yes.
And I think John Ashbery, or no, it was Andre Kudrescu who talked about that in one of his poems, which is, Naomi was very, very prevalent in Ginsberg's works.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Let's see. In 1989 was the River City Reunion in Lawrence, Kansas. And I put together a portfolio of work, including some of the work of Andre Kudrescu and Ann Waldman and Allen Ginsberg and Michael McClure. They were all part of it. I was commissioned to do that. And then I followed that up with Stiletto One, A Ship of Fools, which was a tribute to my personal mentor, William Burroughs.
Yes.
Seriously. I mean, I just put him at the top of almost
everything. I feel that.
Fact, Chuck, I sent you a CD of Abinishi.
Yes, you certainly
William
did.
William Burroughs, Old Bull Lee, is the central character therein. So, he lived in Lawrence, Kansas.
I
lived in Lawrence, Kansas. And he would stand out in his backyard with a shotgun and blast holes in spray paint cans in front of sheets of plywood, and he did paintings that way. So that was fundamental for Abinishi, the character William Burroughs as a specter.
He really was a specter. I'm very fascinated. Okay, sorry. Chuck, if I may. Michael, this is such a great conversation about the beat movement and the beat poetry really captures all of these political and social turmoils that we go through as a society. And I was very, very proud to put on a beat poetry event last April on International Jazz Day and on the very last day of National Poetry Month. So beat poetry brings together poetry and jazz, right? So I had this event at Le Chat Noir. The owner, Ezio Chaviano, kindly opened his doors and let us play in his joint, right? And it was such a great way to allow many different poets from South Florida to express themselves, to read the classics of Kerouac and Ginsberg, and the famous beat poets, as well as like the nouveau poetry, you know, the new beat generation is what I really want to explore. And I think this new beat generation can take issues like what's happening in our current society and in our living history, and put it in artistic expression and really reach people and change people's minds and to forge a better future for our society. So, Michael, we have to talk offline. I would love for you to be a part of the project next year, because Ezio Chaviano, he already said that he's going to let us play at Le Chat Noir again next year. So I'm playing something really, really great for that. Yeah.
Well, I thank you for the invitation, and perhaps Chuck can hook us up via email.
I certainly will. I absolutely will.
Actually, I'd like to send you a copy of my CD, my new CD, because I did it on New American Dream, and it has all the essences that you speak of, including jazz. And anyway, I'd like to send it to you and see what you think.
I love it.
All right. I really want to thank both of you for joining me tonight. This has been a wonderful discussion. I really appreciate it. And it's now time for the station break, so I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, thanks, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist, featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern, Studio A.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne, and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Our final guest of the evening is Frank Cordero. Frank joins us each week from the Des Moines Catholic Worker, and I spoke to him earlier. And I also have some good news. Sheena has agreed to stay online, and she's going to share some of her work with us after we hear Frank. So that's this has really been a fun show, and I think a good one. So, all right, right now we have Frank Cordero.
Yo, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You have caught me off guard. I'm trying to say, oh my gosh, I'm in one of those situations where you, I look at the thing and I see your name on the thing and I'm going, is it 5 o'clock already? Is it Thursday? And of course it is. So I'll sit down in the, stairwell, and if they need me, they'll call me up here. But,
okay.
We can talk. I don't have anything in particular to talk about, to chew your ear on. One of the things that are just continuing to impress on me is my age and my body and the limitations of being 68. I think there are a lot of people like that. A lot of baby boomers out there, I would imagine, yeah, that are, those are the folks I'm speaking to. So it's a lived experience of walking through, the elderly years, as a generation. I can't say I'm really happy about what we've accomplished as a generation. It's apocalyptic, the type of world we're giving our children versus the world that was given to us. And so there's no doubt about it, the seeds of this kind of industrial global power scene was well set before World War II, simply by the convergence of modern industrial human footprint on the planet. We just have consumed ourselves to death, and the death is oil. And now we have this funky science, nuclear science, GMO science, really exotic science, and everybody's trying to catch the best exotic science. But on a day-by-day basis, it's the oil-based global transportation system that's killing the planet. And, you know, we wouldn't need a nuclear bomb. Wouldn't need GMOs. Oil would do enough to kill us. The particular darkness we're living in, we had a trial yesterday, 2 days ago. Al and Ruth went to a one-day trial, jury trial, on the trespass charge. And it's just amazing the questions that our attorney asked the jurors before they were picked about, you know, wasteful money, government wasteful money. You have a bone to pick. You see, and as they were talking about government's wasteful money, this, that, or whatever, never a word about the military-industrial complex.
Real.
And talk about a wasteful money. No, it's assumed that protecting the country is worth every dime. That's how it feels. Huh. That's how people assume.
Well,
if
only it were really protecting the country instead of just going over and destroying people, torturing them, sending drones to destroy everything.
I feel the same sentiments. That's the other thing. The average American doesn't want to hear that. doesn't want to know it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They really don't want to know that there's a drone command center here. And then when we put the military guy on, he couldn't bring himself to say these things kill people. Nothing kills people. We're there to protect. You know, we're there to protect your freedoms, no terrorists to get you. And no explanation. We're trying to, we couldn't even get him to admit that F-16s were used to kill people. We finally got him to admit that munitions were on the planes. It's just, I really can't get anybody, it's just a, it's very frustrating, the darkness that people want to hold on to when it comes to this area. And the whole patriotic, militarist, fascist thing we're dealing with here. And it wasn't always like that, man. I mean, I was here 30, 40 years ago during the Dingman era and the early 70s. This state was a very progressive state, very anti-military. But that's because we ranked number 48 on the chart of who was benefiting financially. But now that they reinvented the military and the army out of the National Guards, these white rural Midwest states are rich territory for the National Guard, and it's a cult. It's an extraordinary cult. Scary. Wow.
It is scary. And and you have to say that was a pretty smart move on their part, making it, you know, financially beneficial to the states to house these things.
They have been setting this up with the National Guard when they were able to federalize them, start sending them as support people. I mean, this is all in the works of having an all-volunteer army that there'll never be an anti-war movement. So they really are using literally 1% of the population serves the military need. And that's it. 1%. Wow. It's still a global military presence.
Oh, yeah.
And our weapons allow us, see, we value our lives so much that we're willing to kill people from Des Moines to save America. It's so pathetic. An ethic that was humed in World War II, crystallized, I would say automatized, in August 6th and 9th, but actually put in practice in the city bombings of Germany and Japan before the A-bomb. That's when the ethic of better their kids than our boys. And that's what happened.
Yeah, those firebombs, man, they were really bad.
Yeah, I mean they're equivalent to the ovens. I mean, come on.
No kidding.
But there's no admitting it. Yeah, but this is a crowd that has buried the Indians and have and enslaved the blacks. So it's not like we are not unfamiliar with this shit.
It's not like the first time.
No. This isn't our first rodeo.
Really?
All right. I got carried away. This should be a good one on the replay. I can't wait to archive it.
You betcha. All right. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you. Thanks, John. I guess we did have something to talk about. All right.
I think we did. Yeah.
I guess we did.
Bye-bye.
All right, brother. Bye-bye.
It's amazing how all of the different guests and different things that we've talked about tonight all seem to fit together. That's happened so often on this show. I plan things around the topic a little bit, but it really just happens. I have I have wonderful guests, and I am I'm really glad to have you joining us, Sheena.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm so honored to be a part of this show. I really like what Frank said in his commentary, and he mentioned this phrase, this military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
And it brings to light a poem that I wrote a couple of years ago called The Tuskegee Airmen. And it was about this one Tuskegee Airman who served in World War II. The background of the Tuskegee Airmen is that there was a troop of black Air Force pilots and fighters that were fighting in World War II against Hitler, against the axis of evil, and there was still segregation in our military. Imagine that there was an air troop that was confined to only African-American military personnel. And I went to a funeral of one of the Tuskegee Airmen down south here in Miami. And I was so moved by the ceremony and by the story of this man who served our country, but still under segregation. Imagine going to war to fight for this country, but in the military, in this military industrial complex, being subjected to segregation in the military. Can you even fathom something like that today? It was just really, I was taken by that.
Yeah.
And when I was first joining these poetry groups locally, I was only reading the poems of other poets. And it wasn't until I met Sherwood Ross, where he used to lean my way and kind of whisper to me. He said, "You know what? You should really read one of your poems." You know, he didn't want to read other people's poems. He wanted to hear what I had to say. I was very honored by that and very inspired by that. And he was really a mentor and an inspiration, and which is why I'm dedicating my first collection of poems, Polyhymnia, to Sherwood Ross. But if it's okay with you, I would love to read the Tuskegee Airmen. This poem I first read at the Miami Poets Soiree, which is hosted by Terry Starr at Pinecrest Library the first Wednesday of every month. She's been hosting this group for many, many years. It's a very prominent poetry group in South Florida. So I would love to share this poem with you.
Well, please do.
Okay. This is the Tuskegee Airmen, and it's inspired by Lieutenant Colonel Eldridge Franklin Williams, United States Air Force, retired. He passed in 2015. This is the Tuskegee Airmen. The sun's light breached black clouds the day the Tuskegee Airmen was buried. Rays far-reaching through the wild blue yonder caressed the shoulders of the widow, her face draped with crepe veil to hide her countenance. The minister clutched his Bible, and holding close all the good book's wisdom, took the graceful widow's hand, imparting to her the Lord's condolence. Black-suited congregants filed into the Baptist hall's wooden pews, shuffling across polished floors. The surviving airmen, in their pressed red coats adorned with medals, sat proudly by the casket where the Tuskegee Airmen lay. A pallbearer approached and remarked, "He looks the same." And other close friends echoed his wry smile, sharing an inside joke carried for years, as if waiting for delivery on this day. Red roses flanked the once fit body of the Tuskegee Airman, his hands elegantly crossed and his red lapel pinned with the emblem of the 332nd Fighter Group and the 477th Bombardment Group of the U.S. Air Force. Funeral ribbons adorned with last sentiments flowed, caressing the altar floor. The open casket was draped majestically with the American flag, red, white, blue. The official Air Force seal affixed on all sides was the last medal of honor the airman was bestowed. As World War II once loomed, young men eagerly enlisted to serve their country, even where Jim Crow's credo of separate but equal bled as a lubricant into the military machine, and black men proudly in queue were knocked down like dominoes, one and the next and the next. Negro re-examination is not recommended was red lettered on the Tuskegee Airmen's falsified medical report, keeping him on the ground. In the flight zoo in Tuskegee, Alabama, black birds took formation just like white birds elsewhere. Delta, Echelon, Boomerang. The grounded airman defiantly moved up the ranks with college degree as his side arm. Respectful salutes were earned as he cleared the hurdle of brown skin and bowed to receive officer status. Finally, donning Tuskegee Airmen uniform, he mentored young men who marched readily in formation in their boots. The church fell silent as six men in dress blues began their slow march towards the Tuskegee Airmen, now laying in state. Heel, toe, heel, toe, heel, toe. The casket's cover was gently clicked shut and the flag slid over, guided by flattened hands moving over its smooth surface with a soft whish. The presiding general called, "Attend, hut!" drawing his detail to attention. Civilians and military alike obeyed. Taps filled the air. The muted trumpet billowing a sound ribbon of sorrow and honor. The ceremonial folding of the flag commenced, pulling, creasing, pleating with precision and respect for symbolism in each fold. Peace, patriotism, equality. Equality eluded the Tuskegee Airman in youth. He eschewed his men's graduation ceremonies, lamenting dreams of conquering skies. He never took flight, yet living to be a gray-haired wonder forged a colorful stronghold for the next generation. The triangular blue-starred bundle was presented to the widow, the officer bowing. With tentative joy, the choir sang the gospel hymn, "I'll Fly Away." And the congregants, military and red tails, took their cue to fall out. The Tuskegee Airmen will be laid to rest in official casket to be interred at Arlington, where the firing party and the Arlington ladies wait. He is beyond the wild blue yonder now, beyond the sun into a realm full of color, where black from white is not discerned, and the Tuskegee Airman commands by his legacy. Thank you.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Wow.
Yes, Chuck, thank you for allowing me to read that. I submitted that for contest this year, and let's see what happens. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's an expression of what's, you know, that's yeah. The important part.
So
thank you.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about this book of poetry that you're going to be publishing?
Yes, Polyhymnia. The Tuskegee Airmen is part of Polyhymnia. If you heard in the poem I just read, there was this beautiful gospel hymn, "I'll Fly Away." You know, it goes, mm-hmm. "I'll fly away, old Lord, I'll fly away. My, yep. Oh my, by my, when I die, I'll fly away." So my poems have always some kind of musical element to them. And I didn't realize that until somebody from, it was one of the youth speak reads that somebody from University of Miami approached me, and she said, I've heard you read your poems quite a bit, and they always have this musical quality. They're always like referring to music. So mm. I I tried to connect with that music, and polyhymnia was born from that. Polyhymnia is one of the seven muses in Greek mythology.
Ah.
So polyhymnia was the muse of like arts and music. So I took that as a title for my collection, which has at the moment 48 poems. And this collection is dedicated to Sherwood Ross because he really, you know, as we talked about for the duration of the show, and as you know, that's archived in New American Dream. He was such an incredible person, always like fighting for human rights, civil rights, and speaking for the little guy and speaking for what's right in this world. And I took really great inspiration from that. And that's why I want to dedicate that collection to him.
Well, that's great. When do you think it'll be out?
I think by the end of the year.
Oh, great.
I'm going to be traveling. I have a retreat planned for the end of September. I'm going to be traveling to Sevilla in Spain to finish with my writing. So, yeah, so by the end of the year, I want to finish this project.
Well, great.
Thank you for asking.
Okay. I look forward to seeing that. And I thank you for agreeing to join us as a monthly guest on the second Thursday of each month. And I...
Oh, absolutely. I'm honored. Thank you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And this has been a wonderful show. Thank you for sticking with me the whole time. And it's really been great.
Been great fun, Chuck. Thank you so much.
Well, good. So this does wrap up another New American Dream radio show, and it's been a really good one. I am so lucky to have great guests, Sheena Powell-Zuri, Philip Ferrugio, Michael Annis, and Frank Cordero. We'll be back on our regular, slate of guests starting next week for the first Thursday. And I'd like to thank all of you who are listening for joining us on the show. I hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And our archive shows are available and also a live feed available at newdream.us. So it's been fun. And I'm going to kind of sing us out here with a song that we used to end every show. And I've been bringing it back a little bit. He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. Been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks he'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned them at Libau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, And without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war. Good night, everyone.
Welcome to Revolution Radio, where you, the listeners, are in charge. Here at Revolution Radio, we present 48 broadcast hours of news and information each and every day. Revolution Radio never sleeps. Revolution Radio is worldwide and borderless information. Revolution Radio is also commercial free. Revolution Radio is supported 100% by you, the listeners. And that's why we appeal to you to donate and support this station and its expenses. You can support us in many available options like archive subscriptions, our seed pack selections, or even my woodworking store. And we also even have Revolution Radio's swag at the Revolution Radio Zazzle store, in which you can get t-shirts, coffee cups, even a baby onesie. Or you can just plain donate to the cause. We cannot continue without your support, and your support is what helps pay the bills. So please, if you wish us to continue, please stop by our station support page and drop a dime on us. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. Data safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation? Is survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents. Imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank or all the